Hey, friend, two quick notes. Maybe you're a brand new listener or you're a regular listener and you just had no idea. I want to let you know about two things. The London Lyceum has an awesome, vibrant online community, and it's open to anyone. If you'd like to join and participate in those discussions and to be active on that, we talk about all sorts of things. We have channels related to everything that we talk about here at the London Lyceum and more. Go to our website, go to the contact page, and just drop us a note, and we'll get you added to it. So if you're interested, go find that, jump on there. A second thing is we also have an exclusive content option for you podcast junkies that gives you a ton of benefits more than just extra podcasts. So just $5 a month, and it's to become a subscriber. You can find that on our resources tab under the podcast. It'll take you right there. It's going to give you a bunch of access to things like the additional bonus episodes that we do here, as well as a free digital version of the Hanover Review every issue that comes out, as well as free access to our reading groups and a lot more. So go check that out. I encourage you to do that. That helps support us to create more resources that directly benefits you. So you're feeding right back in to your own benefit for those sort of things. So we really appreciate your support. Do check those two things out, and I look forward to talking with you soon. On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Patrick Schreiner about his new book, The Transfiguration of Christ. So we cover all sorts of topics like, are there actually dogmatic rules for exegesis? Is that somehow going against the grain of what the Bible is supposed to teach us? Is that putting a straitjacket on it in some way? How do the various symbols, particularly in the Transfiguration, shape our understanding of the narrative of the Transfiguration? And what should we say to pastors who think that this way of reading might be reading far too much into the text than is actually there? So what significance should the Transfiguration ultimately play in the work of our systematic and our practical theology, and how that looks in our daily lives, and much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Welcome to another episode of the London Lyceum. I am your brand new host, Cody Phillips.
And I'm your co-host, Hunter Heisman.
Now, it may be surprising to hear our voices because usually Jordan runs this thing with Brandon Askew's occasional foray. But Jordan has generously decided to kind of redistribute the podcast wealth amongst the rest of us common folk here at the London Lyceum. And so, hence Hunter and I today, and we're really pumped to have Patrick Schreiner on the podcast to talk about his new book on the Transfiguration. He is the director of the residency program, PhD program at Midwestern, and the associate professor of both New Testament and biblical theology at Midwestern, which is awesome in my mind, because I teach both Old Testament and biblical theology at my institution. So I love seeing people mix it up with several different disciplines, I guess. And so so that's wonderful. So Patrick has been on the pod before. I looked it up today. It was September 29th of 2020.
I didn't remember
where you
that.
You came on to talk about your ascension.
Oh, it was the ascension. Okay, cool. Yeah, I forgot about that. It must have been maybe... Yeah. Right when I moved here or something like that to Kansas City, because I published that book right when I was coming here.
And so so it's been a minute. And so in light of that, brother, if there's anything you'd love to just introduce about yourself, kind of who you are, what you love, and a little bit about your family, that'd be great.
Yeah. So we're in Kansas City, moved here a little over 3.5 years ago, taught at Western Seminary in Portland, Oregon for 6 years. Before that, I'd finished my degree at Southern Seminary under Jonathan Pennington. Married to Hannah, 15 years. We have 4 children, 2 in middle school, 2 in elementary school. So we're busy, and it's a fun stage of life, though. I grew up in Minnesota. What do I love? So I grew up a Minnesota Vikings fan. So Kirk Cousins just got traded. So that's a hard one for me. But I live in Kansas City now. And so you can't live in Kansas City without liking the Chiefs. And so very clearly my children like the Chiefs way more than the Vikings, because we can never watch the Vikings on TV and the Chiefs are on all the time. So slowly my loyalties are being transferred. And it's pretty easy when they win Super Bowl after Super Bowl. And then my girls, they like seeing Taylor Swift on the TV. So, you know, it just happens. So we're in Kansas City, and that's what's happening. They always turn, I'm actually looking out my window upon Kansas City, not the downtown. It's not that pretty. I have a Lowe's right here that I'm looking at too. But they changed the fountains different colors based on the sports. It's kind of an interesting Kansas City thing that they do because we're the fountain city. We have more fountains maybe than any other U.S. city. There's a little factoid for you. But they changed, like if the Chiefs win, the fountain before me that I see right now is red if they win. Or if the Royals win, it's blue. It's actually not that pretty, but it's kind of a Kansas City thing. So that's where I am. That's what I'm doing. I'm continue to publish various sorts of books. But as you said, the most recent one is on the Transfiguration.
Awesome. So here at the Lone ICM, we are all about serious thinking for a serious church. And we want to apply that to biblical studies as well. So we want to think through, as we kind of enter the text, how can we approach this with charity, right? So kind of generously thinking through all the various ways in which people read, read scripture. We want to think about curiosity. So we want to be curious. And I would say the Transfiguration is definitely one that piques curiosity for many. We're about critical thinking, want to think deeply and just put rigor into the way that we approach a text. And then we want to approach it through cheerful confessionalism. And one thing that I love is that I think those four values we have at the London Lyceum are really embodied in this book. In that Patrick's done a really great job of just expressing curiosity, critical thinking, interpretive charity, and just a interpretation that ultimately is creedally and confessionally faithful. And so, which ultimately is faithful to the scriptures. And so with that said, brother, if you could just kind of give us a 10,000 foot overview of the Transfiguration narratives, as well as just kind of what sparked your desire to write a book on the Transfiguration in the first place.
Sure. Yeah. So the Transfiguration is recorded in what we call the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's not recorded in John in the same way. We'll probably talk about that later. But it's told in the same sequence of events in every single Synoptic Gospel, which I think is important. Again, we might talk about that later. But essentially, the event is Jesus takes three of his disciples, his inner circle, Peter, James, John, up a high mountain. And as they go up the mountain, Luke says they went up there and they were praying and that the disciples fell into a deep sleep. So I think it's probably at nighttime. It kind of matches the Garden of Gethsemane. But as they come awake, actually, they're awakened by the bright light. And it says Jesus was transfigured before them. That's why we call it the Transfiguration. It's this Greek term, metamorphosis. And different gospels speak of it differently, but they all use kind of the imagery of light, or his face was changed, or his face shone, and his clothes became as white as light. And then suddenly you see Moses and Elijah. They appear with him. And Peter says something about making tents. And, you know, the gospel writers say that he was terrified or he didn't know what he was saying. And as he's speaking, a voice from heaven says, "This is my beloved son. This is my chosen son with whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him." And it speaks about a bright, like the voice coming from this bright cloud, or a cloud that kind of overwhelms them and locks them into this scene. The disciples hear this, they fall on their faces. In Matthew, it says, Jesus came and he touched them. It's also recounted in 2 Peter 1. Peter, who is on the mountain with Jesus, he speaks of it in kind of in the context of Jesus's return. And he says, "We are on the mountain with Jesus. We heard that voice from the heavens." So that's the big picture. If you just kind of forgot, what is the Transfiguration? It happens right before Jesus kind of heads towards Jerusalem. So kind of towards the end of the Galilee ministry, entering his Jerusalem ministry again, the same place in every Synoptic Gospel. Well, your second question was, why did I write a book on it? I wrote a book on it primarily. I was really interested in the event, and primarily because there's not a lot done from a Western Protestant perspective. You can find a lot of Eastern Orthodox tradition on this event. You can find a lot in the Church Fathers on this event, but in not a lot of modern works. Even as I started to do research, it's just there weren't many books that were well known that were written on the Transfiguration kind of in our circles. And so my kind of pet project is to do more neglected aspects of Christ's life. I did the Ascension. I did the Transfiguration. Now I might do Descent, or maybe Gethsemane or Temptation. I have some different ideas for other events I do. And I do think we want to major on the majors of Christ's life. So if you're going to summarize Christ's life, is birth, his life, his death, his resurrection are kind of the main pulls that we think of. But I'm trying to just shine a light, maybe the pun there, right? Shine a light on the other events that we don't think a lot about. And, you know, in the book, I give various reasons for why we don't think a lot about the Transfiguration. It's a mysterious and symbolic event, and I think we don't really know what to do with it. And it's also, it in many ways, you could say it takes place out of, it's out of place. In other words, the timing of it doesn't seem to match what's happening in terms of, it's a preview of the future. It's more than a preview of the future, but if you're going through Jesus's life, it's like suddenly he's transfigured and then he goes back to being normal. And it's like, what was that all about? And so it just sits out of place in terms of like the flow of Jesus's life. So it's confusing for that reason. The Eastern tradition, you know, has taken this towards deification, and they use it in terms of their argument for icons. And so maybe Protestants just kind of avoid it because we don't know what to do with it. It's symbolic, mysterious. And then the other thing I'd say is we tend to focus on the means by which we are saved, the mechanism, the cross. But we don't always focus on the goal of salvation, the telos, the sight of God, where we're going, what we long to see. And I think that theme is evident throughout the scriptures, but for some reason we don't think about that as much. And so the Transfiguration, wow, it is one of those events that I wrote a fairly short book on it. It's only like 150 pages or so, maybe 200 pages. But I really believe I was just scratching the surface. It's one of those books where it has so much to say for Christology, for anthropology, for hermeneutics, for biblical theology, you know, like spiritual formation. I did a little of all of that in the book, but I was just like, wow, each one of these sections could be a whole book. It is an amazing event that the more you study it, the more you think about it, it just holds untold riches, which is why the early church and the Eastern Orthodox tradition have spent a lot of time on it. I was just on another podcast earlier today, and as we've stepped into the modern era and we modern commentators shy maybe away from ideas like divine preexistence, and so the Transfiguration gets lowered kind of on the important events. But for the early church, I mean, Brian Daly has a book, Light on the Mountain, which is the most fabulous book on this event. It's just a bunch of patristic homilies. But they viewed this as one of the most important events because it was so revealing in terms of divine ontology and who Christ was. And that's the same for the Eastern tradition, who emphasized Jesus's preexistence and his glory. And so I think in the modern day, we have kind of tended, even modern commentaries from evangelicals, we don't speak about really what I think we should be speaking about in terms of the Transfiguration. So it just goes by us unnoticed for all those reasons.
That's very good. I mean, I was just really intrigued as I was reading through your work. It's fantastically done. And like you said, it hits on a lot of different things. Just aspects of the Christian life, theology, hermeneutics, practical theology. And it's just so much there. It's historically informed. You talk about this kind of Eastern-Western divide, and you know, I want to get to that deification kind of point. Is deification something that we should be thinking about as Protestants in the Western tradition? What are some confusing things about that doctrine that that your book may help shed light on?
Yeah. So again, Westerners or maybe Protestants, more precisely, don't tend to use that language of deification or theosis. And I'm sure there's a lot of great, you guys maybe have done some podcasts on this as well. But if you actually study it, now that those terms, theosis, deification, they're not used in the scriptures. But if you study what the church tradition has meant by that, it's basically, if I can put it at like the plainest level, it's another term for glorification. Like what actually happens when we are glorified is that we become like him as we see him as he is, 1 John 3:2. We are ourselves transformed. Peter talks about being partakers of the divine nature. We become, Jesus says, like the angels, we become immortal. And so we somehow share and participate in his life. So for me, as I read through the Christian tradition, they all used this term deification. They used it a lot. I think we need to define what we mean, because I do think different people mean different things by deification. We need to be very careful to not blur the creator-creature distinction. So ontologically, there's an unbridgeable gap between the creator and the creature. And if you start speaking about deification in a way that confuses that, I think that's unbiblical and unhelpful. I don't think we become a different species, which sometimes I wonder in the Orthodox tradition if they lean that way. Again, I'd probably need to know more about that and talk to more who are in the Orthodox tradition to know if that's what they mean. It's also in the Orthodox tradition, often it takes place through the sacraments. And so there's some differences that I would hold, but I actually have no problem is speaking this language. And I think ultimately, if we tie it back to the transfiguration, Jesus's transformed being is a picture of our transformed beings. And it only takes place as we are unified to Christ and participate in Christ. As we participate in him, we become like him. And so I think this is what Paul is referring to in terms of the spiritual body, 1 Corinthians 15. And so, yeah, I don't mind using language. I also understand, though, why some might not like using the language, just because it isn't in the Bible itself. But we often use terms that aren't in the scriptures. And so my thing is, I want to have a discussion about it. And for me, it just put flesh, maybe that's a weird way of putting it, but it put flesh on what glorification or sanctification meant. And so I'm not opposed to using it, but I know there's many people who know way more about this doctrine than I do. So I want to be cognizant of what I know and what I don't know.
Absolutely. So as we kind of think about doctrines and dogmatics, you say in the preface of your book that there are dogmatic rules for exegesis, hermeneutical, Trinitarian, and Christological, that enlighten rather than suppress interpretation. So what are those rules, and why should they particularly be embraced within the world of biblical studies, which, as you know, is often not too attuned to those kinds of realities?
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to do in this book was, I could have done just an exegetical biblical theological reading, which you can do that, and it's super helpful to do, and I think there could be more work done on that. And some of the books that I've done have leaned more in that direction. But the Transfiguration, as I studied it more, I really believed, unless you have what I would call kind of the classical categories of Trinitarian doctrine and Christological, and I actually use hermeneutical as well, it becomes very difficult to interpret this event well, because it's such a rich but mysterious event that if you have those kind of guardrails for yourselves, or the classical way that the Christian tradition has thought about certain things, I ultimately think it enlightens exegesis rather than puts a kind of a block to us. And actually, I think as I read whoever was speaking about it in modern terms, I think that their lack of using classical categories prevented them from reading the narrative well, or in the richest depth that you could. So hermeneutically, this one might not be as key as the Trinitarian and Christological, but hermeneutically, I use the four senses in this book. And I don't do that in a wooden way. I do it just in the first section. But the four senses are the literal, allegorical, what we would probably call the typological or canonical reading, the tropological, the moral kind of reading, then the anagogical, which is the eschatological reading. And basically, my point of using that is that, you know, when you read the Transfiguration narrative, you can go very quickly over all the details. Like, he went up on a mountain, there was three people with him, it was after 6 days. And my point in saying, no, all of these things are hugely significant canonically, and they're hugely significant for our own spiritual formation. So I think we've read the Transfiguration too literally or literalistically. And we really need these categories of when we say after 6 days or after 8 days, as Luke says it. What does that mean? Why is that important? And we kind of press into that and start thinking about a seventh day theology and what that means. And why does Jesus bring only three disciples with him? What does that look like? And why are they on a high mountain? And which mountain is this? And so the hermeneutical rules help us simply because it opens our eyes to see the depth and the beauty of this scene. The Trinitarian rules that I use, I might not be able to remember all of them, but I do remember beginning with the confession that God is light in himself, 1 John 1:5. And so however we think about the light of the transfiguration, I think we need to think, no, first God is light in himself. In other words, Jesus, how does this help us? Jesus isn't just receiving this light. He is actually light himself. And so this is different. My argument was the light is not corporeal light. It's not let there be light. This is theophany, Christophany, God light. God is light in himself. So our light, our sun, is just a dim reflection of the light, which is God himself. And so we begin with kind of ontological or essence categories. So that leads us to distinguishing between internal and external works of God himself. And so internally, God is something, and then he externally works in creation. And then that also means we need to correlate the light of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And so the light of the Father and Son of the Spirit is one, but it's also distinguished because God shines forth through the Son and the Spirit. So ultimately, I give a Trinitarian reading of the Transfiguration, arguing that the cloud is the Holy Spirit and that it's appropriate that the sun shines with light and then the bright cloud comes around them, because that matches both the eternal processions and the missions of the Son and the Spirit. So that's a whole nother conversation, but I'm just giving you kind of the preview. And then finally, the Christological rules, I think, are hugely important, probably the most important for this narrative. Some of the things that I say is that we must confess Jesus is truly God and truly man without confusion of the two natures. And so we can say two things at the same time, but it must unite in the one subject. So I think we can speak about Jesus as both God, what is revealed in terms of his godness, and Jesus is also man, what is revealed in terms of his humanity. We can also, the other Christological rules that we know is that he's doubly begotten. So he's eternally begotten from the Father. This is my beloved Son. But he's also begotten in time. And so you have that rule that helps you, again, speak in a double way about Christ. And then maybe the final thing I said was something about the net profit of the incarnation is not a decrease of the Son's divinity, but an exaltation of his humanity. So the church has always confessed it's not that Jesus subtracts anything from himself becoming man, but he adds something to himself, and ultimately he glorifies what he adds to himself. And so those are like the boundary markers, but they're not just the boundary markers. They are the, because maybe the boundary markers aren't even the most helpful way of saying this. It's the tools that I use. You know what I mean? It's the way I move forward in the text to say, here's the categories. Now, what does it mean that Jesus' face shone? Now, what does it mean that the cloud came? Now, what does it mean that the Father's voice spoke and the Son was revealed and the Spirit was there in a creaturely or human, not human form, but a creaturely like image in a cloud? And I think really the church fathers, they were the ones who modeled this type of exegesis really well for me. And ultimately, I think those tools, they enlighten the text.
And one of the things I've read a little bit of the fathers on this issue is not only is that those rules kind of help enlighten the text, but they really naturally flow from the text and some of the symbols with Moses and Elijah showing up, God speaking, saying, listen to him. I mean, it's really a cool interplay that not only are these rules that are being applied to this, but they're actually derived in part, I think, from this. And then also in like Luke 24 and other passages of scriptures are just a good basis of why we do these rules. So I just really appreciated that aspect. Now getting kind of a beyond, I guess, some of the dogmatic rules, but just to the kind of the flow of the narrative of scriptures, how important is the Old Testament imagery, those narratives, those themes, those kind of motives for understanding the transfiguration narrative? What are some of the most important one? Maybe you want to talk to us about mountains in the Old Testament and their importance. We love mountains. We love talking about geography and different things. So that could be one.
Yeah.
It's really, really whatever you want to focus in on that.
Yeah. Point. I think every piece of this narrative, like most of the New Testament, is just interlaced with the Old Testament without having a knowledge not only of Christological and Trinitarian categories, but of the Old Testament itself. it just doesn't make a lot of sense without them, which is why we need our biblical theology to read this narrative again. Well, it might sound intimidating, but I always remind people, like, we're meant to read these things in community with the church together. And so, like, I'm not arguing that every person has to have all of these things, their ducks in a row. That sounds like an impossible task, but maybe different people in your church will have different gifts in terms of how they read, and you can read these things together. And so I'm not trying to set a bar so high that no one can do this. I'm actually saying, no, do this with the whole church, your local church and the church worldwide and past, present, if that makes sense. So, yeah, so little details, like it says a high mountain in Matthew, and I think Mark and then Luke just says a mountain. Interestingly, in 2 Peter, he says it's the holy mountain. But when you think back to the Old Testament, you know, many people will say, okay, is this Mount Tabor? Is this Mount Hermon? Ultimately, they don't tell us which mountain it is, which I think encourages a more symbolic reading. And what I mean by symbolic reading is not that it's not literally or historically true that it happened on a mountain, but rather that he's pulling on that tradition of mountains, and that mountains often signify progress in the covenantal story. And mountains, maybe more importantly, are places of theophany. So probably the most famous one is Exodus 24 and following, when Moses goes up Mount Sinai with three guests with him, just like Jesus goes up the mountain with three guests, and he goes to see God. Ultimately, he goes to interact with God. And the picture that we get is that he's staring into the divide between heaven and earth. And ultimately, that's what mountains are. They are that which spans heaven and earth. You're partially in the heavens and partially on the earth. And so ultimately, I don't think we can understand this story without understanding that this mountain is a mountain of revelation. It's a mountain of theophany. It's a mountain where the disciples get to see God. So again, modern interpreters will often rightly push this towards kind of the future state. And I think that's there. But I think what's happening here is the disciples are ultimately seeing the person of the Son, and in the person of the Son, they're seeing the Father, right? They're seeing Yahweh himself. And this is what Moses and Elijah themselves long to see. So you have not only Exodus 24, but Exodus 33, where Moses asked to see the face of Yahweh. And the amount of concealment in that text is stunning, because Yahweh's like, no, you can't do that or you'll die. But I will show you something. I'll let my goodness pass before you. You'll see my back, but I'm going to cover you with my hand, and you're going to be in a cleft of the rock, and I'm going to move by pretty quickly. And so it's like, I'll show you something, but not very much. And then you also have a similar narrative, I think, in 1 Kings, I always forget if it's 17 or 19, but Elijah goes to the same mountain. He goes into the same cave, and the Lord appears to him, not in the earthquake, not in the fire, but in the soft whisper. And I think it's a narrative of encouragement for Elijah, although that's a debated text. So each of these narratives, though, are pointing to Old Testament saints are longing to see God. And Moses is such a great example, because he saw something of God in the burning bush. He saw something of God on Mount Sinai. And then he's like, I need more. I want more. And it's a good desire. But ultimately, God says, no, that's not where we are in terms of the place of revelation. That time will come later when the Son comes. And so it's totally appropriate here that Moses and Elijah appear, because they are the ones who long to see God. Yes, they represent the law and the prophets, but I think even more so, they are the ones who requested to see the face of Yahweh, and that request is finally fulfilled. And so, and then obviously, like, this is my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. I mean, this goes back to Psalm 2:7, Isaiah 42:1. I would argue Genesis 22, the sacrifice of Isaac. And then Daniel 7 as well. I mean, one commentator said it's like an intertextual chorus. Like, this is my beloved Son is like some of the most important Old Testament texts that we have. So for the Father to come and say, this is my beloved Son is saying, this is the Davidic King. This is the suffering Son. This is the new Isaac. This is the eternally begotten Son. This is the Son of Man. It's like bringing all of these major themes from the Old Testament into unison. And you have to recognize, like, who's on the mountain with him. It's Moses and Elijah, and it's Peter and James and John. Like, this is the foundation of the church. This is the prophets and the apostles. And he says, no, this one is my beloved Son, which makes you think, right, of Hebrews 3 and 4, when Moses was great in God's house, but he was only a servant. It's Christ who is the Son, and he deserves more glory than him. And so in terms of the narrative flow here, I think the author is showing us, yes, Moses and Elijah attest to Jesus, but ultimately the res, right, the reality has come in Christ. Like, they are pointers to the true reality. And Jesus himself will say, listen to Moses and Elijah, right? It's not like they're canceling out their voices, but that their voices ultimately attest to the Son. And so, yeah, this, I haven't even talked about his face or the light. Like, light is always, God appears as fire. Consistently, he appears as fire, whether it's the pillar of fire or on Mount Sinai, or whether it's the smoking fire pot, or whether it's in the temple when the fire cloud comes down, the fire comes down and the cloud surrounds. So then there's the cloud, and then there's the tents, and then there's the face of Moses and the shining. And I mean, I could listen to him, Deuteronomy 18, this is the new prophet. Like, you can't stop. I mean, they fall on their faces. This is what people did before Yahweh. Like, you can't read this narrative without, honestly, like, every single detail being related to something being fulfilled in the Old Testament, which is read Light on the Mountain. And that's what all the patristic homilies do. They are just pulling the whole Bible together in this one event. And some people are like, hey, this is over reading. And I'm like, no, this is canonical reading. This is exactly what they're doing. I've read a review that has said, like, I don't know if all this is happening in this event. And I'm like, I want you to read the early, like, fathers and how they read, because this is exactly what they're doing. And I don't see how we can deny the richness of this story. And it's not just, I know I'm going on and on, but it's not just one of these things. It's that they all support one another. So as you see one thing, you're like, oh, maybe that's true. But then you see, oh, they go up on a high mountain. Oh, it's with three people. Oh, his face transfigures. Like, oh, this is clearly Sinai. Like, everything points to it. So yes, if we only had one of these things, I'd say, maybe it's happening. But it's the congruence and it's the buildup of all of these themes that shows, oh man, this is really bringing our whole Bible together. So there's a lot for you. I could say much more.
No, my Old Testament heart is rejoicing. We have to read the Bible like God actually wrote it, you know?
Yep, so, that's right.
So with that said, kind of transitioning from Old Testament to New Testament, what do you think is the interplay between these synoptic narratives of the Transfiguration and the Gospel of John in particular? You mentioned early on that it's not quite talked about in the same way in John's Gospel.
Yep.
And so what's kind of going on there?
Yeah, so the synoptics, I mean, the one thing I could just say about the synoptics briefly is that the synoptics, the Transfiguration occurs at the same place in all the synoptics. I mentioned that earlier. And it comes post Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah, and then post Jesus's revelation to them. Yes, I am the Messiah, but I'm going to suffer and die and then be raised from the dead. And Peter's so upset about that. So ultimately, the narrative in the synoptics is a moment of hope for them to say, suffering is coming, but glory is on the other side. In other words, the cross is not going to be the end of this. This is a preview of post-resurrection or post-ascension. There's some debate there. But this is a preview of the glory that is to come. So therefore, you can take up your cross. You can have hope. Yes, I am going to die. And you're going to be very confused about that because you didn't expect your Messiah to die. But I will die, but glory is to come. Now, if you read the narrative carefully, though, I think ultimately he's saying glory will come because I had that glory before the world existed. John 17:5 is basically a summary of my book in short. Jesus says, glorify me, Father, in your presence with the glory that I had before the world existed. In other words, Jesus receives a glory as man, but he had a glory as God before all time. And that's where you have to have your Christological categories correct. Like, you can say two things at once about the glory. The glory is received by Jesus. Wait, how can it be received? He is God, right? But he's also man. So he can receive glory as man, but he also is still God. So he possessed that glory from all eternity. And that's the mystery and the beauty of the incarnation. So ultimately in the synoptics, I make the argument, which very few modern scholars do, this is an argument for preexistence. And very few modern scholars will say that for the synoptics. John, preexistence is all over his gospel. And so from the very start of it, he's arguing for Christ's preexistence. So uniquely, he doesn't have to tell this narrative in the same way because it's woven throughout his whole gospel. So scholars have talked about how John transposes the themes of the synoptics into a different register in his gospel. So my argument is, and many people have said this, I'm not the only one, but that John has the transfiguration in his narrative, but it's woven throughout the whole narrative. And we can see that right away in John 1. So it begins with, in the beginning was the Word. Now, how does that connect to the transfiguration? Well, listen to him. He's my word, right? You have the word of Moses and Elijah, but you are to listen to him. And then you go down to John 1:5 and it says, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. What do you think John's reflecting on at that moment? Well, he's thinking of the darkness of the cross, the darkness of the Jewish response to Jesus who ends up crucifying him. But he says, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness will not overcome it. I think he's thinking transfiguration. And then John 1:9 says, this is the true light, the true light. What does that mean? Well, in the epistle to John, God is light. Then 1 John 1:5, right? This is the true light, which gives light to everyone. It was coming into the world. There we have John talking about ontology, true light, and then mission, coming into the world. That's exactly what happens in the transfiguration. Then you jump down even to John 1:14, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us. He tabernacled among us. That's that word, right? Tabernacled among us. Well, how do you see that he tabernacled among us? Well, the transfiguration, it has the cloud and it has the fire, or it has the light, not the fire, but that's a temple imagery. So here's the image where the word actually dwells among us. The glory cloud actually comes down on the mountain and he says, we have seen his glory, the glory of the only son. There we go. Transfiguration imagery from the Father, full of grace and truth. And then one more text, even John 1:18, it says, no one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side, but he has made him known. So no one has ever seen God, but how do you see him? Through Jesus Christ. So I make the argument in the book, it's appropriate. And then now we're going again to Trinitarian and Christological categories, but it's appropriate that the Father's voice, you hear his voice because he's the Father. And he doesn't have a mission. He sends the Son and the Spirit. And it's appropriate that the Son takes on flesh. And it's appropriate that the Spirit also takes on a creaturely or cloud form here because they have missions. And so it is true that God dwells in unapproachable light and that no one has ever seen God. But we've also seen God in the face of Jesus Christ. This is where, man, if you read the Bible, you're going to be really confused because it's like, you can't see God. You can't see God. You'll die if you see him. And then they're like, and you see God through Jesus Christ. And you're like, well, how do those two fit? Well, if you have your Trinitarian categories in place, then you see, oh, you see God through the person of Jesus Christ. Is it Philip who asked, show us the Father in John? And Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That's precisely what's happening in the Transfiguration. So that's just John 1. I think it's woven throughout his whole gospel. So it's not narrated, but the themes are just everywhere. And you mean, think about Hebrews 1 through. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God, right? That's transfiguration language, I think. That's light from light, Nicene Creed imagery. And so the early church used the transfiguration to help them articulate his ontology, which was the big debate in the early church. Who is this Christ figure? Is he preexistent? Is he one with the Father? And ultimately, the Christian answer was yes. And it was the transfiguration that they used again and again to prove that.
You know, Patrick, I mean, one of the things that you're just highlighting is one of the reasons why I love this book. I love this book not only for the insight it has into the transfiguration narrative, but for the model in which it puts forth on how I think hermeneutics ought to be done across the scriptures. And I'm just thinking through this, you know, a lot of our listeners are pastors. So I just kind of think of put on like a pastoral ministry professor kind of hat for a moment. And I'm just thinking through, you know, you mentioned one reviewer kind of set, you know, charged you with overreading, which I don't think you're doing at all, which doesn't say too much. I mean, people charge me of overreading a good bit.
So we're in the same camp, you know.
But, you know, how would you counsel pastors, you know, pastors who've caught this vision for hermeneutics, but maybe some in their congregation are not quite there with them just yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've been influenced by a variety of different sources. How would you counsel them to pastorally walk a church to kind of begin to start reading the Bible this way, in a way that's pastorally sensitive, that demonstrates virtue and love, that isn't just trying to run roughshod over people, you know, and we're not cage stage Trinitarian hermeneutic type people. You know, how would you counsel people pastorally to kind of begin implementing these rules in their preaching and their own studies?
Yeah. I mean, I would say if you're already employing these, just like show people and do it. I would say the best way to teach people is to show them with a text. In other words, as you're preaching, employ them. And then sometimes it might be appropriate to say, here's what I did, and this is why I did it. And other times you just do it, and it's almost more caught than taught. I think hermeneutics is almost usually better caught than taught. In other words, people see it happen, and they see the text come alive, and like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. That answers a lot of questions for me. Wait, what did you just do? And then they start reverse engineering, and they're like, oh, that's super helpful. And so honestly, I think like I'm a pastor, and I think what I try to do is I just try to do it with almost without naming it. And it's not like I'm trying to sneak it in. I'm just showing them like, this is how you can read, and this is a good reading. And then I ultimately want to show them it matters for your life, because I think most people in the church want to walk out and say, what does that have to do with me going to work tomorrow? And they want some practical payoff. Now, obviously, you can have great sermons that or lessons that are just meditate, reflect, behold his glory. But I do think all of this, even the transfiguration, he's trying to encourage his disciples to keep going. And so you look at Paul's epistles, he's talking to real people. He's speaking to them about how this affects their everyday life. And so I have to work, because I'm, you know, a biblical studies theologian type. I have to work a lot on thinking, okay, like, how does this affect the single mom who has to watch her kids tomorrow and get them to school and then go straight to work? And how does this affect the grandma who's in the church, or the grandpa who just lost their spouse who they've lived with for 50 years? Those are the type of questions I think we also have to ask. And I think the transfiguration, I mean, it's such a hopeful text in terms of suffering, in terms of that's not the end of the story, that your affliction isn't the end of the story, that glory is to come. And it ultimately gives everyone hope who is in Christ. And so my basic answer is just do it. Just show them what you're doing. And then sometimes peel back the, show them how you got there, to kind of show them what you're doing. And I think at that point, you'll teach a generation how to read by just doing it.
Awesome. So just to kind of conclude our time on one other just practical question for our listeners. So you've talked a lot about temple imagery, kind of this, a lot of cultic language throughout the transfiguration narratives. And someone's mind might go to a text like Romans 12 in the beginning of being a living sacrifice before the Lord. So how might we kind of bridge these two texts in a way that just really fleshes itself out in the Christian life?
Yeah. Yeah. Romans 12, 1 and 2 is totally appropriate to go to, because there's only four times in the whole scriptures that this term metamorphosis, which is the term for transfiguration, occurs. And that's Matthew and Mark. And then you have 2 Corinthians 3:18. And then you have Romans 12:2. Now in 2 Corinthians 3:18 and Romans 12:2, it's usually translated in English as be transformed. But that's the same word for transfigured. Interestingly, every time it's applied to us, the English, probably based on Tyndale, has decided it's transformed and Jesus is transfigured. But probably helpful just even to shake up Christianese, just translate it transfigured and see how that hits you. You know what I mean? Like, do not be conformed to this world, but be transfigured by the renewal of your mind. It kind of is like, oh, it just hits you in a new way. But 12:1 is tied into this, and I think it's tied into the transfiguration. Present your bodies as living sacrifices. And what have we just talked about? What was Jesus about to do? He was about to present his body as a living sacrifice. That's precisely what he was doing as he was going to the cross. I mean, it's Holy Week right now, and we're going towards the cross and the resurrection. And this is how this scene is not divorced from the cross. It's not divorced from the story of the scriptures, because we are called as Jesus to present our bodies as unto death, right? But ultimately, that will mean the transfiguration of our being. We will be transformed by the renewing of our mind so that we may test the will of God. And so ultimately, Romans 12, 1 and 2 gives us a picture of actually going towards death is part of your transfiguration. And most of us, rightly so, avoid death. And when I'm talking about symbolic death, like as Christians, we are to die to ourselves continually, whether that's our desires, our passions, whatever that is, we're to die to ourselves and live unto God and live unto others. But everything in our flesh screams out to us, no, live unto yourself. But Jesus says the only way to enter into glory is to actually continually die to yourself. So that's what Romans 12, 1 and 2 is telling us. And so this is not an impractical event where we're like, cool, we get to look at shiny Jesus. No, that's not what this is ultimately about. It's ultimately about our transfiguration. That's how Paul uses this term, both in Romans 12 and in 2 Corinthians 3:18. He says, we are being transfigured from one image of glory to the next as we behold him. And so ultimately, as you enter into Holy Week, if whenever this is published, right, our goal, what we do is we behold him so that we might be transformed.
Rock and roll. So thank you so much for your time today, Patrick. This has been a super just stimulating and encouraging conversation. I would encourage all of our listeners to go to your favorite book retailer and grab yourself a copy of Patrick's book, in order that we could all just be encouraged and built up in all that the transfiguration has for Christian life and thought. And so with that said, thank you for listening. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.